That evening, with 24 hours to go until the Kimball's ball, Claudius Turnbuckle arrived at the suite with an excited expression on his face.
Good news! I think my men have finally found D.L. and the Golden Gate.
Conrad didn't have the heart to tell his old friend he had known the probable identity of D.L. for several days.
Tell me about it.
There's a saloon on Grant Street in the Barbary Coast called the Golden Gate, and it's owned by a man named Dex Lanigan.
And you think he's the one who sent those killers after us?
I'm certain of it. The initials match, and my investigators report that the men who work for Lanigan carry a token like the one you found in the street to identify themselves. I'm sorry it's taken so long, Conrad, but I'm convinced this is the answer we've been looking for.
I think you're right. Excellent work, Claudius, as always.
Lanigan has a reputation as a power in the criminal underworld along the bay, but he came out of nowhere about 3 years ago. About the same time, he could have struck a deal with Pamela, in other words.
It all makes sense.
They continued to discuss the situation for several minutes, and if Turnbuckle noticed Conrad wasn't quite as excited as he might have been if all the information were new to him, he didn't mention it.
But here is the really interesting part. Acting, probably at his wife's behest, Lanigan has bullied his way into society, and, as a matter of fact, they're both supposed to be in attendance at a party given by Madison Kimball and his wife tomorrow night.
The ball at the Kimball Mansion? I'm going to that affair, Claudius.
I thought you might be. I had one of my men dig up a picture of Lanigan, so you'll recognize him if you see him there.
Turnbuckle held out a folded newspaper. Conrad didn't have to feign eagerness as he took the paper. He didn't know what Dex Lanigan looked like, so as he studied the photograph printed on the front page of the newspaper, his interest was genuine. The picture showed a man standing beside a carriage parked in front of a large building that appeared to run the length of an entire city block. The man was tall and seemed to be well-built, wearing an expensive suit and a derby. The hair under his hat was fair. His face was rugged and a little angular, and although the photographer hadn't been close enough for Conrad to get a good look at Lanigan's eyes, there was something hawkish about the saloon owner. Maybe it was just his imagination, Conrad told himself, but Lanigan looked dangerous. The building behind him had large, fancy windows, and a large sign on it read, "The Golden Gate, fine wine and spirits, games of chance, entertainment, everyone welcome."
This was taken not long after the place opened. One of my men dug it out of the morgue at the Chronicle.
Conrad nodded. He should have thought of that idea himself. He was sure Jessup Nash would have helped him. But at least he had an idea what Lanigan looked like, although he suspected the man's appearance would be somewhat different in evening wear at a fancy Nob Hill party. Conrad would know Lanigan when he saw him, though. He was certain of that.
You're going to have to be careful if you confront him there. Lanigan has a reputation as a bad man to cross.
I intend to be.
What we need now is something we can hold over Lanigan's head in order to make him talk. That won't be easy. Criminals like that can be very closed-mouthed.
Maybe what I should do is pretend not to know him. That way I can introduce myself and act like I'm not suspicious of him at all. He might let something slip.
Perhaps. I think it's more likely we're going to have him followed and maybe send undercover agents into that saloon of his to find out anything that's really useful.
Whatever you say.
Really? That's not like you, Conrad. No offense, but you always want to be right in the middle of things.
That hasn't worked too well so far. Maybe it's time to give your way a try.
I won't let you down. You have my word on that. But do try to find out whatever you can by talking to Lanigan at the Kimball's ball.
I will.
Turnbuckle left the room, leaving Conrad to smile, shake his head, and pour brandy into a snifter. He was sitting in one of the armchairs, sipping the drink, when a commotion suddenly broke out in the hallway.
You can't go in there.
I must see him.
Oh, no, you don't.
Frowning, Conrad set the brandy aside and got to his feet. Conrad jerked the door open to see Morelli struggling with a small, shapely female. Scratches on his face oozed blood where she had scratched him. As Conrad stood looking on in surprise,
off me!
Morelli succeeded in getting his arms around the girl in a bear hug and lifted her off her feet from behind.
I told you, girl, no little trollop like you is going to be bothering Mr. Browning.
Let me go. I must talk to him.
Morelli, what's going on here?
He hadn't gotten a good look at the woman. She and Morelli were turned partially away from him, and her dark hair hung in front of her face. As Morelli turned toward the door, his captive gave a defiant toss of her head, throwing her hair back. A shock went through Conrad as he recognized her as Carmen, the young prostitute from Spanish Charlie's.
Please, senor, you must help me. No one else can, and if you don't, they will kill me.
Let her go, Morelli.
But, sir, a girl like this ain't for the likes of you. I'm not sure how she even got into the hotel. Usually the staff don't let such tramps get anywhere near the guests.
I know her. Now let her go.
Morelli lowered Carmen until her feet were on the floor, then released her, stepping back with a frown of deep disapproval on his face.
What you do in your personal life is none of my concern, sir.
That's right. It's not.
Conrad took hold of Carmen's arm. She looked like a terrified doe about to bolt.
Come with me. You'll be safe here. I give you my word on that.
Hans and Ulrich may have followed me. I tried to get away from them, but I don't know if I did.
I'm not afraid of Hans and Ulrich, and I'll wager that Morelli here isn't either.
No, sir. I don't know who those lads are, but I ain't afraid of anybody that draws breath.
Conrad managed to steer Carmen toward the door of the suite without making it seem like he was forcing her. As they went inside, Morelli started to follow, but a hard look from Conrad made him stop. Conrad closed the door behind them, leaving the bodyguard in the hallway.
All right, Carmen. Can I get you anything?
Maybe a drink, senor?
Conrad hesitated, unsure whether he should be giving liquor to someone as young as she was, but considering where she worked and what she did for a living, he supposed it was a little late to be worrying about things like that. He poured a little brandy into a glass and handed it to her. She clutched it with both hands, which were trembling slightly, and drank down the brandy. That seemed to steady her nerves.
Gracias, Señor Browning.
How do you know my name? How did you know you could find me here?
After the big fight at Spanish Charlie's, after Ling Wan came in to help you get away, I followed you. It was Dutchie's idea.
Conrad hadn't realized anyone had followed him away from the dive that night, but he supposed a slender young girl like Carmen could have slipped through the shadows behind him without him noticing.
Why did Dutchie want you to follow me?
I think he wanted to take revenge on you for starting trouble. He would have sent Hans and Ulrich to kill you later, but when I told him I followed you all the way here to the palace, he seemed to change his mind about that.
Conrad wasn't surprised. Dutchie must have realized there was more to his troublesome visitor than met the eye.
I thought you must work here, maybe as a bellboy. I have a cousin who works in the hotel as a maid. Dutchie told me to talk to her, to tell her what you look like and find out if she knew you. She told me there was no one working here who looks like you, Señor Browning. Then she told me about one of the guests. About you.
And you told Dutchie?
I had to. He would have killed me if I tried to lie to him.
When you told him, he was even more interested than he was before, right?
Sí.
Dutchie probably sensed a possibility for blackmail. A man wealthy enough to stay in one of the palace hotel's finest suites, who prowled around squalid saloons and taverns like Spanish Charlie's, usually had secrets he would be willing to pay to keep quiet.
I know you didn't have any choice in what you did. I'm not upset with you.
Oh, truly, senor?
Truly.
She moved closer and reached up to throw her arms around his neck before he could stop her.
Oh, gracias, senor, gracias. I thought you would be angry with me for betraying your secret. I'll do anything to earn your forgiveness.
There's nothing to forgive.
Conrad untangled her arms from his neck.
And even if there was, all you'd have to do to earn it is ask. But there's not, so you don't have to worry.
He held her hands to keep her from grabbing him again.
Now what's all this about Hans and Ulrich threatening to kill you?
Well, Dutchie said he knew someone who would pay him a great deal of money if he told them about you. But he and I were the only ones who knew, and I think he was worried I might try to reach this person, whoever he is, and sell the information first. So he decided to get rid of me, even though I work for him and killing me would cost him money. I'm only a cheap Mex whore. Dutchie can make more by selling the truth about you than he can from me.
Conrad had a hunch he knew who Dutchie intended to sell that information to. Dex Lanigan. Lanigan must have put out the word that he was interested in anything he could learn about Conrad Browning, and Dutchie would know what a powerful, important man Lanigan was in San Francisco's underworld and would be eager to curry favor with him.
How do you know Hans and Ulrich intended to kill you?
I overheard them talking in their mongrel tongue. They think I do not know what they say, but I understand a little. Enough to know Dutchie told them to kill me and dump my body in the bay. I slipped out and ran away, but I didn't know where to go. And then I thought of you.
You already sold me out to Dutchie, remember? What makes you think I'd be willing to help you?
Because I remember how kind you were to me at Spanish Charlie's. You could have done what you paid for and then asked me your questions, but you did not. And I remembered as well how you asked about the Golden Gate. Dex Lanigan owns that place, and I think Dutchy plans on telling him about you. But maybe I could get to Senor Lanigan first.
So you're not above a little blackmail of your own, eh?
My life has been a hard one, Senor. I've learned to do what I must to survive.
How much do you want?
Oh, nothing, no money.
Then what do you want?
I told you I have a cousin who works here in the hotel. Her father, my uncle, is a fisherman. If I could get to his boat and hide there, he could take me away from San Francisco, take me to someplace safe. This is what I want.
Why do you need my help to do that?
Because Hans and Ulrich and maybe Dutchy himself will be out searching for me. I am sure if any of them see me, they will kill me on sight. But I saw the way you fought, Senor. I know you could protect me from them and make sure I got away safely. This is what I want from you.
Conrad studied her closely and didn't see any sign that she was lying. Her story held together and made sense.
We'd need to go tonight.
Si, Senor, as quickly as possible.
As usual, Conrad didn't take long to make up his mind. He didn't owe the girl anything, and helping her escape from the men who wanted to kill her wouldn't gain him anything. Except the knowledge that he had not only saved her life, but also helped free her from a hellish existence. He couldn't turn his back on her, even though that might be the smartest thing to do. She had already told Dutchy who he was. She couldn't do anything else to hurt him.
All right, let me get my hat.
Conrad already had the shoulder rig for the Smith & Wesson in place, so he left it on and didn't strap on his regular gun belt. When the two of them stepped into the corridor, Morelli got up hurriedly from the chair.
I have to go out for a while, Morelli.
Then I'm going with you, sir. Begging your pardon, of course, but I've got my orders.
It may turn out to be dangerous.
Doesn't matter. Mr. Turnbuckle said to keep my eye on you, so I'm keeping my eye on you.
Very well. The Senorita will tell us where we're going.
To the waterfront, where the fishing boats are docked.
Lead the way.
They left the hotel through the rear entrance Conrad had used a few nights earlier. As far as he could tell, no one paid any attention to them. But he hadn't noticed Carmen trailing him the other night, so he warned himself not to be too confident. After they had gone a block or so, he hailed a horse-drawn cab and helped Carmen into it. Morelli jerked a thumb at the driver's seat.
All right up top.
The cab rolled up and down San Francisco's steep streets toward the waterfront.
I cannot tell you how grateful I am for your help, Senor Browning. But maybe I could show you?
That's not necessary.
Conrad lifted a hand to stop her from moving any closer to him.
Where are you going to go, Carmen?
I have two cousins who will take me in.
Conrad held out some folded bills and pressed them into her hand.
Take this money. It'll help you make a fresh start.
Oh, gracias. Senor, gracias. I cannot believe anyone can be as good as you are.
Far from it. I just want you to have a chance.
The cab dropped them off in an area where the night air was thick with the smells of salt water and rotting fish. Carmen pointed.
My uncle's boat is down here.
She started along the wharf, flanked by Conrad and Morelli. A short time later, they came to one of the docks that extended into the water with boats tied up on both sides of it.
Along here!
The area was dimly lit by lanterns hanging here and there, casting feeble yellow glows into the gathering fog. Something stirred inside Conrad, a sense that not everything was as it should be. No one was around. The docks shouldn't have been completely deserted, even at that time of night. When he heard footsteps on the damp planks behind them, he knew his hunch was right. He stopped and started to turn, then froze as he felt the sharp point of a knife in Carmen's hand penetrate his coat and shirt and dig into his flesh.
I am sorry, Senor Browning. I really am. But if I had not done what they wanted, they would have killed me.
What's this?
A trap. And the Senorita was the bait.
It was true. Half a dozen big men had followed them onto the dock, blocking their escape. Conrad didn't see Dutchy, but even in the bad light, he recognized two of the men as Hans and Ulrich. The others were strangers to him, but equally large and dangerous looking. Conrad had no doubt they worked for Dex Lanigan. Morelli started to reach under his coat.
Don't, or I will kill Mr. Browning.
Sir, what do you want me to do?
Conrad didn't answer for a second. The wheels of his brain were spinning rapidly. It wouldn't take much strength for Carmen to slide that blade between his ribs and pierce his heart. Not much physical strength, that is, Conrad thought. But it would take the sort of resolve he wasn't sure the girl possessed. The odds were against him and Morelli, but Conrad had faced long odds before. Besides, he figured the chances of them surviving if they surrendered were non-existent. To think was to act, where Conrad was concerned. He answered Morelli with action. Twisting his body away from the knife in Carmen's hand, planting a hand against her shoulder, he gave her a hard shove. She plunged off the edge of the dock into the water. He hoped she could swim, but if she couldn't, there were a lot of boats tied up along the dock. She could grab a mooring line to keep herself from sinking. While the splash from Carmen falling into the water hung in the air, the six bruisers charged toward Conrad and Morelli. The bodyguard pulled a thick black leather sap from under his coat and met their attack, wading into his enemies as he struck out right and left with the shot-filled weapons. Morelli couldn't stop all of them, though. Conrad reached for his gun, but one of the men tackled him before he could pull the .38. He went down, sprawling on the dock. Seeing a big ham-like fist coming at his face, he jerked his head aside. The punch landed on the dock. Conrad brought his elbow up under the man's chin and forced his head back. A heave threw the man off to the side, and he barely caught himself before he rolled off the dock. Conrad scrambled to his feet just in time to meet the charge of another man, who landed a hard straight left, catching Conrad in the chest with such force it seemed to paralyze him for a few seconds. A second looping punch landed on Conrad's jaw and knocked him down again. A few yards away, an attacker grabbed Morelli by the arm and held it while another man sunk a brutal blow in the bodyguard's belly. He fell out of sight. Conrad was a good bare-knuckles brawler, but there were just too many of them. They were all around him, and no matter which way he turned, trying to escape the punishment, another man was there to smash a fist into his face or body. The same was true for Morelli. The bodyguard put up a valiant struggle, but he was outnumbered by men who were his equal when it came to fighting. He didn't have any more chance than Conrad did. Suddenly, a blow landed on Conrad's temple, and he saw a brilliant flash and felt like his head was coming apart. Instead of blackness, a great white void expanded and engulfed him. He didn't hear anything, didn't feel anything, and didn't know anything as he fell endlessly through nothingness. The man who got off the train the next morning was tired from sitting up the whole way during his journey. He could have booked a sleeping compartment if he'd been willing to wait for a later train. Certainly, he could afford the cost of such a luxury. What he hadn't been able to afford was the time. So he had ridden sitting up in a Union Pacific passenger car from Montana to Salt Lake City, dozing when he could, then caught the next Southern Pacific westbound for San Francisco. He would have preferred to take a couple of weeks and make the trip on horseback, but there was no time for that either. He looked out of place as he disembarked among men in expensive suits and ladies in fancy dresses. He was medium height, but the high-crowned, cream-colored Stetson he wore made him appear taller than he really was. Broad, powerfully muscled shoulders stretched the faded fabric of a blue work shirt. He wore jeans and plain functional boots. The Colt revolver holstered on his right hip was plain and functional too, as was the Bowie knife sheathed on his left hip. He carried a simple carpet bag containing a few spare clothes and several boxes of ammunition. He hadn't brought his saddle because he hadn't brought a horse with him and didn't expect to need one. He felt that lack keenly. Despite everything that had happened in the past 40 years, a part of him was still the young cowboy he had been. Part of him felt that a man without a horse just wasn't a man. He shrugged off the feeling and walked through the lobby of the train station. When he stepped onto the street, San Francisco spread out before him. A sigh escaped him before he could stop it. He didn't like big cities. Never had, never would. But it was where he was needed. A buggy pulled up in the street outside the depot. Claudius Turnbuckle climbed out and strode hurriedly toward the newcomer.
Frank, I meant to be here when your train arrived, but I was delayed at my office by the police.
What's wrong?
It's Conrad. I don't know how to tell you this, but he's missing.
Missing?
I'm afraid so. If you'll come back to the office with me, I'll tell you everything we know.
Frank Morgan, the drifter, the man some called the last true gunfighter, hadn't been aware he had a son until a few years earlier. Now that he had gotten to know Conrad Browning, now that they had fought alongside each other against common enemies on several occasions, Frank would move heaven and earth to help the young man if Conrad needed his help. The lawyer motioned Frank toward the buggy.
Mr. Turnbuckle, sir!
They looked back to see a tall, slender man in a brown suit and hat coming toward them, also from the direction of the train station.
Arturo! The two of you are on the same train?
The two of who?
You and Frank here.
Arturo looked at Frank.
You're Mr. Morgan, sir.
That's right. I reckon you must be the Italian fellow I've heard about.
Arturo Vincenzo. I had no idea we were on the same train, or I would have sought you out and introduced myself after I boarded in Carson City.
They shook hands.
It is an honor to meet you, sir. Mr. Browning has spoken a great deal about you, always in the most glowing terms.
That wasn't always the way he talked about me, and you can bet a hat on that.
Something's happened that you don't know about, Arturo. Conrad has disappeared.
Good Lord. Tell me about it.
Frank and I were on our way to my office. I was going to fill him in there. You look pretty tired, though, and I know you're still recuperating from that bullet wound, so perhaps we should drop you at the hotel.
Nonsense. No offense, sir, but I'm coming with you and Mr. Morgan. Dr. Taggart said I was fit for travel, and I can't possibly rest until I know what's happened to Mr. Browning.
That's just it. We don't know. But come along, and I'll fill you in on all the details.
I hope so, because I haven't followed much of this so far. I don't even know what Conrad was doing here in San Francisco.
It's not a pretty story.
It never is.
One of Turnbuckle's assistants had brought in cups of coffee for the three men.
I suppose the best thing to do is just start at the beginning. You're a grandfather, Frank.
What are you talking about, Claudius?
Do you remember Pamela Tarleton?
Be hard to forget her, after what she did to Rebel.
Yes, well, that wasn't the extent of Miss Tarleton's evil. I don't wish to be indelicate about this, but it seems that when Conrad decided to call off his engagement to her, she was, already in the family way.
Conrad's grown into a fine young man, but before that, he could be a damn fool sometimes.
Following the affair in New Mexico in which Miss Tarleton's father was arrested and then murdered, she returned to Boston and gave birth to twins, a boy and a girl.
Named Frank and Vivian.
That news rocked Frank. Learning he had a pair of grandchildren had been a shock, without hearing they were named after him and Conrad's mother, the great love of his life.
Go on.
For the next half hour, Turnbuckle and Arturo explained how Conrad had found out about Pamela's cruel plot against him, and how he had set out on a cross-country odyssey to find the missing twins.
The boy should have told me. I would have come and given him a hand.
I believe he was determined to do this himself.
He had Arturo here helping him.
It's not quite the same thing. Mr. Browning and I are not related. Therefore, no emotional complications and implications existed that would have had he called on his father for assistance.
I'd never stopped him before.
He was never searching for his own children before.
Frank shrugged and turned back to the lawyer.
So the trail led here.
That's right. Conrad felt, and I agreed with him, that he was closing in on the children at last. We located some clues pointing toward a man named Dex Lanigan, who owns a saloon in the Barbary Coast. We figure Pamela Tarleton made a deal with Lanigan. He may even know where she hid the children.
Well, then I reckon it's time we went and had a talk with this fella, Lanigan.
It's not that simple. Lanigan is going to be at a society party tonight that Conrad was also going to attend. He hoped to find out more information that way. But this morning, when one of the bodyguards I've hired to look out for Conrad went to the Palace Hotel, where he's staying, Conrad wasn't there. And neither was the guard who was on duty last night.
Well, they might have gone somewhere and just haven't come back yet.
Yes, well, I might have thought the same thing, if not for the fact that the police showed up here with the news that Thomas Morelli's body was pulled out of San Francisco Bay this morning. Morelli was the man who was with Conrad. He had been badly beaten and his throat was cut. His wife knew he was working for me and told the police about it when they talked to her. The poor woman sent them here.
That sounded pretty bad, all right. Frank knew there was a good chance Conrad and this fellow Morelli had been together. Since Morelli was dead, then... Frank gave a little shake of his head. He wasn't going to let himself think the thought that had just crossed his mind. Conrad wasn't dead. He knew it in his heart.
What did you tell the police?
That Morelli had been guarding Conrad. There was an attempt on his life as soon as he got to town.
Lanigan had men watching for him, probably at the train station.
That's what we think now. We didn't know about Lanigan at the time.
You didn't tell the police you think Lanigan's to blame for what happened to Morelli?
There's no proof of that. And I know Conrad didn't want the police involved in the matter of the children. He thought he stood a better chance of recovering them safely himself. I knew you'd be arriving today, and I wanted to consult with you first.
Well, why did you track me down and send me that telegram if you knew Conrad didn't want me mixed up in it?
Because you and I are friends, Frank. And those are your grandchildren we're talking about. It seems to me you have a right to be involved. Besides, Arturo wired me from Carson City and told me Conrad seemed to be getting more reckless and obsessed about the whole thing.
I didn't want to go against Mr. Browning's wishes. But the more I thought about it, the more I came to believe you could help him, Mr. Morgan. And he needed that help. Did you know, when we first met, Mr. Browning was calling himself Kid Morgan? For the longest time, I thought he was just some Western gunslinger. I had no idea that he was actually a financier and businessman, and quite a successful one at that.
Back then, he had to put all that behind him. I reckon he thought he was Kid Morgan, too. That's who he wanted to be.
But we can't be someone we're not. Our pasts won't allow that.
Frank shrugged. They were drifting off the trail here.
If Conrad's still alive, Lanigan's probably got him stashed somewhere. He said Lanigan owns a saloon in the Barbary Coast?
That's right. It's called the Golden Gate. What are you going to do, Frank?
I reckon it's time to pay a visit to Dex Lanigan and his Golden Gate Saloon.
The only good thing about the pain in his head, Conrad thought, was that the dead no longer felt such agonies. That meant he was still alive. Unless he had died and gone to hell for all the evil things he had done in his life. Even though he was no expert on theology, it seemed unlikely to him that hell would smell like rotten fish. That unpleasant odor filled his nostrils, with another smell lurking under it that might be salt water. He kept his eyes closed and didn't move, making an effort to keep his rate of breathing from changing. If anyone was watching him, which certainly seemed possible, he didn't want them to realize that he was awake. As he lay there, he concentrated on letting details about his surroundings seep into his mind, helping him not to think about how bad his head hurt. He was lying on his stomach, with his head turned to the right and his left cheek pressed into what felt like a hard wooden surface. That surface moved under him, not much, just a faintly perceptible rocking motion. When Conrad put those things together, the tang of salt water, the reek of fish, the steady movement of the boards on which he lay, he came to the inescapable conclusion that he was on a boat, lying either on deck or down in a hold. Probably in a hold, because he didn't feel any air moving. Even through closed eyes, all he could sense was darkness. That meant it was either still night, or the darkness was another indication he was below decks. He decided to risk cracking one eye open. He raised his right eyelid a fraction of an inch, not really enough for him to see anything, but enough to let in any nearby light. Nothing. The blackness continued to surround him. If he couldn't see anything, that meant nobody could see him. He opened both eyes. After a moment, he lifted his head. Fresh waves of pain rolled through his skull, so intense he had to squeeze his eyes closed again until the throbbing subsided. Eventually, the pain lessened. Conrad shifted to determine if he was tied up. His arms and legs were free, which was a bit surprising. On the other hand, if he was locked up in the hold of a ship, where could he go? Shanghai? The word sprang into his mind, and a horrified shudder went through him. He was in San Francisco, after all. The town was notorious for all the men who had been drugged, kidnapped, and taken aboard ships bound for the Orient. By the time those unfortunates regained consciousness, the vessels were well out to sea, and they had no choice but to work. If they refused, it was a simple matter for their captors to knock them in the head and toss them overboard for the sharks. Because of the destination that lay across the Pacific for many of these ships, it became common to say that a man had been shanghaied when he was drugged and forced to join the crew. Would Lanigan do such a thing to him? Conrad didn't doubt for a second the man was capable of it. He might think dooming Conrad to such a hellish existence was more punishment than simply killing him. It was even possible Pamela might have come up with the idea herself when she struck her deal with Lanigan 3 years earlier. But no matter whose idea it was, Conrad knew he had to get out. He could tell by the slight motion of the ship that it was still riding at anchor, probably in San Francisco. If it had already sailed, it would be moving around much more as it rode the waves. If he could get out of the hold, he could still escape before the ship was out at sea. He pushed himself into a sitting position and waited for the pain in his head to subside. Looking around, he searched for even a tiny crack of light that would indicate the location of a hatch. He didn't see anything. Maybe there wasn't a hatch that led on deck. There had to be some way into the chamber, though. A door and a bulkhead, maybe? Before making a move, he made sure he was alone. He hadn't heard anyone else moving around, nor had he heard any breathing. But it was possible the men who had attacked them on the dock had thrown Morelli in with him.
Morelli! Morelli! Are you there?
He heard something that might have been far-off footsteps, and a low, barely heard moan, but not a human one. That was a foghorn, Conrad realized. He reached out into the darkness and felt around him, searching for a bulkhead or possibly the ship's curving hull. When he didn't feel anything, he moved onto hands and knees and crawled forward, using his left hand for balance and keeping his right extended in front of him. He hadn't gone very far when his fingertips brushed against something. At first he thought it was a wall, but in feeling around, he discovered it was a large crate. It gave him something to lean on as he struggled to his feet. His head spun crazily as he stood up, and for a few seconds, he thought he was going to fall, forcing himself to stand still. The world steadied around him. He swallowed the feeling of sickness welling up in his throat. Steadfastly ignoring it, he sat on the low crate for a few minutes, bracing himself with his hands on his knees. With the resilience of youth and the rugged life he had led the past couple years, some of his strength came back to him. While sitting there, he took stock of what his captors had left him. It wasn't much. He had his boots, his trousers, and his shirt. His coat and hat were gone, and so were the shoulder holster and the .38 Smith & Wesson he had carried. His pockets were empty. No coins, no matches, nothing. If he was still locked up when the ship sailed, he would have no way to prove that he was Conrad Browning. Not that the captain and crew would have cared anyway. They had to know what was going on. Probably Lanigan had paid them off. His only chance was to get off the ship before it sailed. Frank insisted on paying a visit to the Golden Gate Saloon alone.
This fella Lanigan knows who Conrad is and has spies watching him. He's bound to know who you are too, Claudius.
What about me?
You've got a bullet hole in you that's still healing. You probably shouldn't have traveled all the way here from Carson City to start with.
The doctor assured me it would be all right as long as I took it easy.
That means you don't need to be getting mixed up in a ruckus.
Do you intend to start a ruckus in Lanigan's saloon?
Well, I'm not exactly planning on it, but you never know what's going to happen. Sometimes I think trouble's in the habit of following me around.
Yes, I know the feeling quite well. The same thing is true of your son.
I don't doubt it. He comes by it honestly. Anyway, no offense, Mr. Vincenzo, but you don't exactly look like the sort of hombre who'd patronize a Barbary Coast saloon.
I suppose that is true. But please, call me Arturo.
That's Italian for Arthur, isn't it?
That's right.
I used to know an old mountain man whose real name was Arthur, even though nobody ever called him that. He barely remembered it himself. Haven't seen him in years. He must be dead by now. He'd be almost 100 if he's not. The chances of Lanigan or anybody who works for him knowing who I am are pretty slim. Anyway, even if somebody recognizes me as Frank Morgan, not all that many people know Conrad and I are related.
Pamela Tarleton did. There's no way of knowing what she might have told Lanigan.
That's true, but I'm willing to run the risk. If I can get Lanigan alone, he'll tell us what we need to know.
My God, Frank! You can't be thinking about torturing the man!
Well, this is my son we're talking about here. And my grandchildren. And a man who'd make a deal with a she-devil like Pamela Tarleton, who brought nothing but suffering to everybody around her. I'll do whatever I have to, Claudius. I don't reckon it'll come to torture, though.
If it does, I don't want to know about it.
Neil.
Ugh.
Conrad stood up and moved toward the sound of the approaching footsteps. He hit his left shin on something and reached down to discover he had run into another crate. He made his way around it and continued moving forward with his hands outstretched in front of him. A moment later, he touched a wall. He guessed it was the bulkhead that closed off the compartment. Running his fingers along it, he found a door. On the other side of that door, the footsteps came closer. Not only that, but dim yellow lines appeared along the edges of the door. Whoever was coming had brought along a lantern. Conrad pressed his back against the bulkhead, not knowing if the door would open toward him or away from him. If he was behind the door when it opened, that might give him a chance to jump the visitor. He'd have to be careful not to break the lantern and start a fire. Or maybe that would be the best thing to do, he realized. If the ship was burning, the crew probably would be too busy to pay much attention to him. As the footsteps came to a stop outside the door, Conrad set himself, his muscles tense and ready for action. A key rattled in a lock. The door came open and light spilled into the room. Conrad winced from the glare, his eyes narrowing instinctively.
What the hell?
The man stepped into the room, lantern held high in one hand, a heavy old revolver in the other. In the second before Conrad struck, he saw that the man wore the tight shirt and white duck pants of a sailor. Then he clubbed his hands together and brought them smashing down on the back of the man's neck. The sailor staggered forward, but didn't collapse or drop the lantern or gun. He swung around and slashed blindly with the revolver, forcing Conrad to leap back or get brained by the gun. The man pointed the weapon at him, but Conrad charged anyway, diving under the revolver and tackling the sailor around the waist. The man went over backward, and the lantern flew from his hand. Flames shot up as the kerosene spilled from the shattered reservoir and caught fire. Conrad hammered punches into the sailor's body. He knew the smell of smoke would bring more of his captors on the run, and he wanted that gun in his hand before they arrived. He closed his fingers around it and tried to wrench it out of the sailor's grip, but the man held on to it stubbornly. Lowering his head, the sailor butted it into Conrad's face. Conrad turned his head in time to take the blow on his jaw and cheek rather than his nose. The impact jolted him enough to set off more explosions inside his skull. He drove a knee into the sailor's belly, finally causing the man's grip on the revolver to loosen. Conrad jerked it free and tried to climb to his feet, but he heard the pounding of swift footsteps and knew he might be too late. By the light of the fire that was spreading through the hold, he saw several more men rushing down a companionway toward the open door. Before he was able to get the gun turned around so his finger could find the trigger, one of the newcomers charged into the room and swung a club. The thick bludgeon cracked across Conrad's forearm and sent the gun flying out of his hand. The man swung the club in a backhanded blow at Conrad's head. He ducked under it and hammered a punch to the man's solar plexus. Men were all around him, and he was tackled from behind. Conrad was dragged down and hammered with fists. Several men held him down. Their weight pinned him securely to the deck.
The fire's out, thank God. He could have burned us right down to the waterline.
Knowing his escape attempt had failed made a bitter, sour taste well up under Conrad's tongue. He might not get another chance.
Get him on his feet!
Somebody had brought another lantern. Its smoky light washed over Conrad as he stood in the grasp of two sailors. Several more surrounded him, ready to pummel him into submission if he tried to put up a fight again. The man who stood in front of him wore a blue jacket and had a captain's cap tilted back on his bald head. His nose had been broken at least once in the past, and his eyes had a permanent squint. He was short, but powerfully built.
Try to burn my ship, will you?
He stepped closer and without warning swung a fist, sinking it into Conrad's belly. Conrad would have doubled over in agony if not for the men holding him up.
You'll learn. You're nothing but an animal now, and I'm your lord and master. Yeah, it's a long way to China and back. Be plenty of time to break you.
Conrad lifted his head.
Go to hell.
He knew what would happen. He didn't care. He saw the big, knobby-knuckled fist coming toward his face and didn't try to get out of the way. The blow exploded on his jaw with stunning force and drove his head back.
There's the idiot who almost let him loose. Sweeney? You know you weren't supposed to come down here alone, blast it! Once we're out to sea, you'll have some lashes coming, mister. I let him go. He ain't going nowhere.
Conrad couldn't keep his balance. He crashed down on the deck. The place stunk of the recently extinguished fire, to go along with the sickening smell of rotten fish. The door closed, and darkness surrounded him again.
We sail tonight, Browning. Once we do, you're all mine. This voyage is gonna be a living hell for you, mister.
Too late, Conrad thought. He was already in hell. That was his last thought as he passed out. Frank had the feeling he was being followed even before he reached the Golden Gate Saloon. The instincts developed over a long, hazardous life sensed the eyes watching him. But when he glanced around on Grant Street, he didn't see anybody particularly suspicious. The sidewalks were busy on both sides of the street, but no one seemed to be paying much attention to him. A man dressed in range clothes was something of an oddity in the big city, but not enough to make most folks stare. Most of the people bustling back and forth on the other side of the street were Chinese, since Grant Street was the boundary line between the Barbary Coast and Chinatown, but none of those scurrying figures even glanced at Frank. Their heads were down as they went about their business. Frank spotted the saloon up ahead. It was large and prosperous looking, and he couldn't help but wonder how much of it had been paid for by Pamela Talton's money. It was early in the day, but even so, the Golden Gate was busy when Frank went in. Quite a few men were lined up drinking at the long horseshoe-shaped bar. To the right were tables where more men sat with glasses and bottles, and to the left were the poker tables, faro layouts, roulette wheels, and other games of so-called chance. The place was elegantly furnished with lots of polished hardwood, gleaming brass fixtures, and crystal chandeliers. The air in the Golden Gate practically reeked of money, along with the usual saloon smells of sawdust and beer. In the rear of the room, a broad staircase led up to a second floor. Frank took note of that, but went to the bar and ordered a beer from a bartender in a red silk shirt. All the bartenders wore shirts like that, as did the men running the games. The women were clad in low-cut red gowns. The colorful get-ups made the workers easy to identify.
There you go, cowboy.
The bartender set the mug of beer in front of Frank.
That'll be 4 bits.
Well, sort of expensive, isn't it?
If you can't afford it, there are plenty of other places in San Francisco where you can get a drink. Tex.
Didn't say I couldn't afford it, just said it was sort of high, that's all.
He dug a 50-cent piece out of his pocket and slid it across the hardwood. The bartender let go of the beer mug and made the coin disappear. The fellow would be more than a mite shocked if he knew what this customer, who looked like a down-on-his-luck grubline rider, really could afford, Frank mused. He didn't waste a lot of time thinking about the riches he had inherited from Vivian Browning, but his lawyers assured him he was one of the wealthiest men west of the Mississippi. Lawyers had been known to lie, of course, but Conrad kept a pretty close eye on the ones who worked for him and his father. Or at least he had, before all the business about the missing children had come up. Frank knew what it was like to find out suddenly that you're a father, and couldn't blame Conrad for being distracted after he'd found out about the twins. Frank had never been much of a drinker. The few times in his life he had found himself crawling into a bottle had come close to being disastrous for him. A good cup of coffee or a phosphate was more to his liking. But he was able to nurse the beer convincingly as he looked around the saloon's big main room. His gaze lingered on the games.
Thinking about trying your luck? Our games are strictly on the up and up, cowboy.
I've heard stories about the fella who owns this place. Rumor is, he's some sort of shady character.
You can't believe everything you hear.
This was in the newspaper.
Can't believe everything you read, either. Especially in a rag like the Chronicle.
Maybe not. But before I risk my hard-earned money, I wouldn't mind meeting the hombre. I can size up a fella pretty fast and tell whether or not he's square.
You really think you're gonna just waltz in here with God knows what on your boots and meet a man like Mr. Lanigan? Wise up, mister. We don't need your business. Maybe you better just move on.
Hold your horses. I didn't mean any offense. It's just that where I come from, when you do business with a man, you get a chance to shake his hand first.
This ain't Texas.
The bartender glanced around. Frank had already spotted several big, rugged-looking gents who didn't seem to have any reason for being there unless it was to take care of any trouble that started. He didn't want the bartender setting the bouncers on him, not because he was afraid of the men, but because he hadn't found out anything yet. He hadn't even laid eyes on Dex Lanigan, as far as he knew. One of the bouncers had caught the heads up from the bartender and started in Frank's direction, his craggy face hardening into a cold mask as he approached. Suddenly, several men burst through the saloon's front doors, brandishing hatchets, and charged at Lanigan's bouncers. The bouncer who had been closing in on Frank forgot about him and swung around to leap into action as he and his comrades met the attack. Frank was as surprised as anybody, but he stayed cool-headed as trouble erupted around him. The intruders wore silk hoods over their heads that completely concealed their features, along with quilted jackets and loose-fitting trousers. It was impossible to tell from their yells what nationality they were, but he had a hunch they were Chinese. The hatchets told him that much, along with the Golden Gate's proximity to Chinatown. One of the bouncers pulled a gun from under his coat, but as he brought it to bear, one of the attackers leaped in and swung his hatchet. Frank saw the bouncer's gun fly into the air, with the man's hand still clutching it. The customers scattered as they tried to get out of the way of danger. One of the bartenders reached under the bar and brought up a sawed-off shotgun. Frank was ready to dive to the floor, knowing that buckshot was about to spray all over the place. But before the bartender could fire the scattergun, one of the hatchet men threw his weapon. It spun glitteringly through the air and hit the bartender in the forehead. The bartender dropped the shotgun and collapsed as crimson flooded over his face. It wasn't Frank's fight, so he knelt between a couple of overturned tables to let the violence ebb and flow around him. One of the saloon girls was on her hands and knees nearby, trying to crawl through the madly charging horde. She was about to fall down and probably get trampled to death when Frank reached over, took hold of her bare arm, and hauled her to relative safety next to him. She threw her arms around his neck and clung to him.
Oh, my lord! Mister, help me!
Hang on. We're gonna stay right here until things settle down.
They're crazy. They're gonna kill us all.
Who?
Those Chinamen. Diamond Jack's men.
The girl's words confirmed his guess that the attackers were Chinese. He knew the Tongs, the criminal societies ruling Chinatown's underworld, often warred with each other and with the white hoodlums from the Barbary Coast. The daring, broad daylight attack had to be part of some ongoing hostilities between Dex Lanigan and one of the Tongs, Frank decided. It was the only explanation that made any sense. He hoped Lanigan didn't get killed in some Tong skirmish before he could find out what had happened to Conrad. Most of the saloon's customers had made it to safety, either fleeing up the stairs to the second floor, piling out through the doors, or in some cases, the windows, or huddling behind the bar. The girl clutched at Frank as the body of one of the bouncers landed on the floor close to them. The man's throat had been laid open by a swipe from one of the hatchets, and blood poured out of the gaping wound. Frank risked a look. He saw that all of Lanigan's men were down, and so were a couple of the Tong warriors. Somewhere outside, policemen rushed toward the scene of the bloody battle. One of the remaining hatchet men suddenly strode toward the overturned table where Frank and the girl had taken cover. He was a big man, and the outlandish garb made him seem even bigger. Blood dripped from the hatchet he held. Frank pushed the trembling girl down so he could shield her better with his body and reached for his Colt. It might not be his fight, but he sure as blazes wasn't going to just sit there while some loco hombre chopped him up with a hatchet.
Please, Mr. Morgan, you must come with us. Your son's life depends on it.
What do you know about Conrad?
There's no time to explain. You must come with us.
The hatchet man reached for the girl.
And this one, too, since she heard me speak your name.
The girl tried to scramble away. Frank saw the hatchet man's hand tighten on the handle of his weapon and realized the man might kill the girl rather than leave her behind to talk. Frank had no doubt he could draw his gun, fire, and kill the hatchet man before the hooded killer could strike. But there were more of them, and if he gunned down one, the others might chop him up, along with the girl. Besides, they knew who he was, and they knew something about Conrad. He realized he had to play along in order to find out what that was.
Come on.
Frank grasped her arm again.
I won't let them hurt you.
No, no!
She tried to pull away. Frank closed his other hand into a loose fist and struck a short, sharp blow to the girl's jaw that stunned her. As she sagged against him, he lowered his shoulder and let her weight drape over it. He came to his feet.
Let's go.
Hey! That crazy cowboy's kidnapping Connie! Somebody stop him!
Nobody got in Frank's way, though. Not with the hulking figure beside him gripping a bloody hatchet. They passed through a lane created by the other hooded men, then suddenly were outside in the sunlight.